Let's talk for just a minute about specifically the gain of body fat, about obesity, and how an excess amount of insulin can make us fat.
Right. First, let's think about our fat cells. Our fat cells are just basically little balloon-like structures that are filled with fat. They can expand or contract depending on how much fat goes into them. And all they do is store body fat. The human body is designed in such a way that we usually eat more than we need at any given meal, but that's the way it's supposed to be. And the body takes this incoming fuel, uses it for its immediate energy needs, converts the rest to fat, and stores it away in the fat cells. And then, when we don't eat, which is between meals and at nighttime, the body goes in and harvests this fat from the fat cell and brings it out and burns it for energy.
So in the normal state, we have a number of calories coming in, more than we need. We store some away for later, and then when later comes, we use them. And everything should be in balance. The amount of fat going into the fat cell should equal the amount coming out, if everything metabolically is working like it should.
If everything's working like it should. And we're fortunate that we have these fat cells. You may not think so, but we really are, because if we didn't have these fat cells, we would be like hummingbirds, and we'd have to eat constantly just to keep ourselves going. But because we've got this capacity to store energy, we can eat once every 5 days, or five times every 1 day, or four times every 2 days. It really doesn't matter, because the fat cell will accommodate to that. But the problem comes in when we store way more fat in the fat cells than we pull out.
And in general, that problem's brought about by the biochemical or metabolic glitch that we call hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance.
The fat cells, like many, many other systems in the body, work on a series of switches. And in this case, the two switches are the two hormones, insulin and glucagon, that we've talked about before. Now, insulin puts fat into the fat cells, and glucagon, which is a counter-regulatory hormone, it does just the opposite of insulin. Glucagon pulls fat out of the fat cells. Now, the two, insulin's the dominant hormone, so when insulin's up, glucagon's more or less going to be hidden away. So when you're in a status of excess insulin, you're always going to be putting fat into the fat cells. But insulin has really almost a more important function, and that is that it keeps the fat in the fat cell. I mean, its job is to fill the fat cell up. So not only does it put fat in, but it doesn't let fat get out.
It's kind of like having a big bank account, but losing your passbook. You got lots and lots stored, but you can't get to it.
That's right. And when insulin's up, you can't get the fat out of the fat cells. Even if you don't have any fat to put in, what's in there you can't get out.
And that's why some people on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet that may have an insulin problem, maybe keeping their insulin elevated all the time, may not eat a whole ton of calories. They may say, gosh, I just don't eat that much. But they're not losing any body fat because their insulin's staying up and they can't get to the fat cell to retrieve those calories and burn them up.
And so if the insulin's up all the time, it makes the fat cell kind of like it has a one-way valve where fat can only get in and can't get out. And when that happens, the fat cell's going to get larger and larger and larger and larger. So we've got to do something to reverse that in order to be able to get the fat out of the fat cell.
And that calls for a nutritional change, the kind of change that we talk about in the Protein Power Plan. That's going to set the stage with these two opposing hormones for the fat to come pouring out of the fat cells and be available to you for energy. That's one of the big benefits. You have boundless amounts of energy once you can start to access that stored body fat.
Now, if you've been on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet and you've had difficulty losing weight, this is why. One of the other components, really, of this whole insulin resistance syndrome is that people who have this underlying problem, they don't do well on low-fat diets. Let's look at the reason why. As we've said before, food is composed of three things, fat and protein and carbohydrate.
And really the fourth, water, but we don't need to talk about it right now.
And protein and fat are generally found together. All the best sources of protein also contain fat. And those are meat and eggs and dairy products, really, and even tofu. So when we cut fat, we almost always cut protein. Now, there's a little equation that says when you cut protein, you reduce your metabolic rate. So that's one thing that happens to you when you go on a low-fat diet. By cutting fat, you cut protein, and you reduce your metabolic rate. But the second thing that happens is that when you reduce fat and you reduce protein, what are you left with?
Carbohydrate, and that's about it.
That's exactly right. You're left with carbohydrate, and people on low-fat diets eat lots of carbohydrates. That's why they're called low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets. They eat bagels, they eat bread, they eat pasta, they eat rice, they eat potatoes. They eat all these starchy, carbohydrate-y foods that don't contain any fat, and what those foods do is they stimulate the release of insulin. And insulin is the problem, Insulin is what causes people to store fat, not dietary fat. And this mistaken focusing on dietary fat that we've been doing in this country for the last 15 or 20 years has allowed everybody's insulin to get out of control. And that's why we're seeing this explosion in obesity, because it's not dietary fat that makes us fat. It's insulin that makes us fat.
And you know, so many folks are out there trying to follow the USDA food pyramid. You did an interesting little experiment that was related to the contents in the food pyramid.
Yeah, if you take the food pyramid, the USDA food pyramid, with its servings of bread and pasta, and you convert that to macronutrients, to the fat, protein, and carbohydrate, what you find out, what you end up with, is a pyramid that has, right up at the top, it has about 15% protein. The next level down, you have 25% fat, and then the bottom level is 60% carbohydrate. So we have a pyramid that's 60% carbohydrate, 25% fat, and 15% protein. So I went down to my local farmer's exchange and tore some labels off of some bags of swine fattening mixture. Now, I could have gotten cattle fattening mixture, but I picked swine because pigs have a metabolism that's very similar to humans. And so I looked at these labels, and I did an analysis of what pigs are fed on a feedlot to fatten them up. And I designed my own feedlot pyramid.
And basically, what was in that feedlot pyramid?
Well, when you design it, when you lay it out based on everything that they use to fatten pigs, what you find out is that the pigs get 14% protein, they get 26% fat, and they get 60% carbohydrate. Does that sound familiar?
Sounds a whole lot like the food pyramid. So what you're telling us is that the food pyramid is a feedlot pyramid, and the same nutritional structure that most of our current nutritional wisdom would tell you would make you lean and healthy is identical to what they fatten hogs on the feedlot with.
That is exactly correct.
Well, isn't it strange that it's fattening Americans?
Not really.
So, what do you have to eat to get lean? That's really what we want to know. How do you turn this whole thing around?
Well, we have two strategies, actually. Number one, we want to reduce insulin levels. And number two, we want to increase glucagon levels. And by doing that, we're going to get rid of the base of the big iceberg that we've talked about previously. So that's our strategy, decrease insulin and increase glucagon.
And you know, that's really easy to do. When you look at what the three macronutrients do to those two hormones, it's very, very simple. When you eat protein, you get a little rise in insulin and a matching rise in glucagon. Those two hormones come up together. So every time that you're eating protein at a meal or a snack, you're doing a good balancing thing for your metabolic hormones. And you're going to promote the loss of fat out of the fat cells just by eating that good quality protein.
And when you restrict the carbohydrate in your diet, you're going to bring about a rapid decrease in your insulin levels. And when you bring down your insulin levels, then your glucagon levels can rise. So you can do both things by restricting the carbohydrate in the diet. And so by following a more carbohydrate restricted diet, you're going to be able to access the fat in your fat cells. You're going to reduce your body's own production of cholesterol. You're going to get rid of excess body fluid that you've been retaining. You're going to decrease your blood pressure. You're going to stabilize your blood sugar. And when you stabilize your blood sugar, you're going to feel more energetic, and you're going to feel less hungry, and you're going to get rid of lots and lots of cravings. So just by that one simple act, by restricting the carbohydrate in the diet, you're going to see lots of profound good changes.
That's right. And you know, sticking to this kind of plan is going to be easier than you ever imagined, because when you get harmony in the metabolic system, when blood sugar is stable, when the level of insulin is stable, when you're drawing fat effectively out of fat stores to meet your energy needs, the signals to the brain that make you want to eat certain types of food also stabilize, so you don't have this constant craving, these cravings for carbs and for sugar that just make you break from your diet and undo all the good you've been trying to do. We get letters from all around the country and people saying, finally, I am not so focused on what I eat. Every time I turn around, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to eat next. I'm feeding my body what it is that it needs. And it makes all the difference in the world in your ability to stick with the plan.
In fact, what we often find is that people have such an appetite suppression on this program that they tend to undereat. And it's really important that you make sure and get all the good, high-quality protein that you need, that you calculate that you need on this program, because it's very important to keep your metabolism up and replace your lean tissue and be able to build enzymes and skin and nails and hair and all the other protein structures.
And the point of this always is not going to be losing weight. We want you to lose fat, that's true, and that's a happy side benefit of a diet that's designed to make you lean and healthy. That's what we want for you. You know, as often as not, patients come to us not because they're overweight and want to lose weight, but because they're concerned about their cholesterol, their triglycerides, their risk for heart disease. And really, this kind of a program was designed in its earliest phases to deal with those problems. We sometimes see patients who come to us who, even on medications for those problems, are unable to get their cholesterol and triglycerides to normal, and it's quite concerning to them.
And because there is so much information out there about cholesterol and so many people who are worried about cholesterol, scientists have begun to break cholesterol down into all of its many different components. And now there are so many components out there that it can really become confusing. So we want to go through just a little bit and define some of those for you so that when you get back a cholesterol blood profile, for example, from your physician, you'll be able to understand what it all means. There are several different components. Number one is total cholesterol. That really is a measurement of all the cholesterol of all different types, good, bad, and indifferent, that is in your blood. Then you have what's called LDL. That's low-density lipoprotein, but you'll see it written LDL. And LDL is the so-called bad cholesterol. And that is a cholesterol that really is taken up into the arteries, and that's the one that seems to cause the most risk of heart disease.
Now, one thing you want to remember is that LDL all by itself, if it's normal, unaltered LDL won't be taken up into the arteries. That LDL has to be changed, and there are a number of ways that it can be altered. It can be oxidized, or it can be attached to sugars that are in the blood. And once it's altered, then it becomes really attractive to the things that trap it in the artery wall. So you don't want to stress too much over LDL unless it's going to be an altered form of LDL. And unfortunately, it becomes an altered form if you're eating a low-fat, high-carb diet or if you smoke cigarettes. That's another way that it gets altered mightily, and you don't want to smoke cigarettes for that reason alone.
Or it can become altered, as you said, if you have high blood sugar. So that's another reason to get your blood sugar down. But although most attention has been focused on total cholesterol and LDL, as it's turning out, as more research is done, the really most important types of cholesterol or fat in the bloods are HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, the so-called good cholesterol, and the triglycerides. And triglycerides are just fat in the blood that aren't necessarily associated with cholesterol. And those used to be thought of as sort of being indifferent as far as your heart disease risk is concerned. But now, with new research, it turns out that the triglycerides are very important, in fact, probably the most important component, that combined with the high-density lipoprotein, the HDL.
Now, all of these names can sometimes get very confusing. High-density, low-density, what does that all mean? And really, it's based upon their weight. And when they take blood and they take this cholesterol out and they spin it down in a rapid centrifuge, it layers out the very heavy, highest density, the most dense cholesterol, goes to the bottom. That's the HDL. And then the low density is a little higher up. The very low density is a little higher up. And the triglycerides are kind of like the cream that floats to the top of milk. They're the very lightest fats in the blood of all of them. And that's really the only difference between those things is their weight.
Is their weight and actually what they do.
What they do.
Because the LDL is carrying cholesterol to the tissues, the HDL is kind of scavenging the cholesterol from the tissues and bringing it back to the liver so that it can be gotten rid of. But as I said before, the two most important factors are the triglycerides and the HDL. In our own practice, those are the ones that we look at the most closely, because people who have high triglycerides and low HDL are really the people that are at risk for heart disease. And what people often find, and you may have experienced this yourself in going on a low-fat diet, that low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets tend to raise triglycerides and lower HDL, which makes the ratio even worse, because really the most important factor is the triglycerides divided by the HDL.
In fact, some recent work from Harvard has looked at that very issue. And when they took people for heart disease risk and they evaluated those two blood fat parameters, the triglycerides and the HDL, what they found is if the triglyceride to HDL ratio was 5, then they were at risk to some degree for heart disease. And the more above 5 it was, the more at risk they were. The more below 5 it fell, the less risk there was, and in fact, between the highest and the lowest, the risk for heart disease was 17 times more in the people that had a high ratio of those two numbers than those who had a low ratio. So taking your triglyceride number and dividing it by your HDL number is going to give you a measure of that risk for heart disease. And a very interesting study was just done in Italy that looked at those things and related them not just to heart disease risk, but to longevity.
Yeah, that's the centenarian study. A group of Italian researchers took people or found people who were over 100 years old who were in good health. They still had good minds. They were still active. They were still vigorous. They still lived the kind of lives we would all like to live if we were over 100 years old. And they ran batteries of lab tests on these people, and they were looking for the commonality, the things that they all had the same. And some of them had way elevated cholesterols, others had low cholesterols. They had blood values all over the place, but the things that they had in common were that they all had low triglycerides, they all had moderate to high HDL levels, and they all had lower fasting insulin levels, the very things you get on a protein power type of plan.
And so you can really take heart that your risk for heart disease and the likelihood that you're going to live a long and healthy and productive life is going to be increased by adopting this kind of eating. It's a very, very healthy way to eat.
If you've discovered that you have elevated triglycerides, the absolute quickest way to bring them down is to cut the carbohydrate in the diet. That makes triglyceride levels drop like a rock. If you find out that you have low HDL and you want to get it up, what's the best thing to do?
Follow this kind of diet and exercise.
And
eat more fat.
Eat more fat, especially monounsaturated fat. That fat, for some reason, has been found to raise the levels of HDL the most rapidly. And good sources of monounsaturated fat are the things we've talked about before: olive oil, avocados, macadamia nuts, lots of different kinds of nuts and seeds, and those kind of foods have lots of good monounsaturated fat in them. So if you want to lower your triglycerides and raise your HDL and really better this ratio, what's the best thing to do?
Follow the protein power plan, exercise, and eat more monounsaturated fat. You know, a lot of folks come to us and they're on drugs to lower their cholesterol. So many people nowadays are taking drugs to lower their cholesterol and their triglycerides. And it would probably be helpful for you to understand a little bit about how these cholesterol-lowering drugs actually work.
Cholesterol is made in the body, really in every cell, but the lion's share is made in the liver, and it's made in a step-by-step-by-step process. And each one of the processes is catalyzed by a particular enzyme, and there's one specific enzyme in there that kind of controls the whole thing. And since medical researchers have learned of the existence of that specific enzyme, they've been desperately trying to develop drugs to inhibit that enzyme, because by slowing down that enzyme, they can decrease the production of cholesterol. And that's what these statin-type drugs do, is they inhibit that particular enzyme.
You know, there's another way to inhibit that enzyme. You can inhibit it by not stimulating it. And there's a very important hormone that the body makes that causes that enzyme to work faster and more efficiently, and consequently causes the body to make more cholesterol. That hormone is?
Insulin. So insulin stimulates the very enzyme that all these high-powered, expensive cholesterol-lowering drugs inhibit. So if you're running your insulin up at the same time you're taking these drugs, you're kind of working at cross-purposes.
And so often, folks are put on those drugs, and then they're also put on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. Well, you now know that eating a diet that's high in carbohydrate is going to make their insulin levels higher. When they raise their insulin levels, they're going to stimulate that important enzyme. And they're spending lots of money every month taking a drug to inhibit that enzyme. So they're just going around in circles. They're not making the kind of progress they could make just by taking away that insulin stimulation.
And the bad thing about these medications, aside from their expense, is that they really don't decrease what we call overall or all-cause mortality. In other words, when you take these drugs, you just substitute one set of risk factors for another. You may decrease your risk of dying from heart disease a little bit, but you increase your risk of dying from certain cancers and from other problems. So you're just really substituting one risk factor for another. And you can do it without increasing any risk factors, simply by lowering your insulin levels.
And that's what the Protein Power Plan will do for you. All you have to do is change the way you eat. Give your body the right tools, and it will take those tools and it will do the work for you. It's very wise. It knows what to do if you just feed it right.
Now, if you're really concerned about your cholesterol, if it's not coming down the way that you would like to see it come down, there is something that you can get at a health food store that's going to help bring it down. And that's called no-flesh niacin. And that's basically just a vitamin. But guess what? That's the only substance that's ever been shown that's a cholesterol-lowering substance that actually does reduce all-cause mortality. In other words, you're not just substituting one set of side effects for another. And you can buy that at any health food store, and you can take 500 to 1,000 milligrams three times a day and bring about a nice cholesterol-lowering without really increasing any other side effects if you're really concerned about your total cholesterol. But usually, just going on the protein power plan, you're going to find that your triglycerides drop. You will always see that, and you will see that your HDL goes up. And remember, those are the two important factors.
You want to be careful, too, when you go to the health food store to get no-flush niacin. There's also a product that's called time-release niacin, and that one has been shown to cause some liver problems. And so you don't want to take time-release or sustained-release niacin. You want no-flush niacin.
And while we're on the subject of cholesterol-lowering drugs, one of the most important substances that the body makes for good heart health, which is really what you're trying to do by lowering cholesterol with these medications, but this important substance is called coenzyme Q10. And sadly, all these statin-type cholesterol-lowering drugs actually inhibits the body's production of that very important substance. So if you are on a cholesterol-lowering drug, if your physician has put you on one of these cholesterol-lowering drugs, make sure that you're taking coenzyme Q10 or CoQ10, which also you can find at any health food store, and take about 100 milligrams of it a day.
While we're on that topic, when you begin to apply the Protein Power Plan and you're using it to reduce cholesterol and triglycerides, and you're coming off, with your physician's help, of the cholesterol-lowering drugs that you've been on, you should consider yourself deficient in coenzyme Q10. And so when you adopt this plan, if you've been on cholesterol-lowering drugs, it's a good idea to take coenzyme Q10 at least for a while to make sure that you raise your levels until your body can rehabilitate itself.
So now we're ready to go, so let's move on and take a look at how we can actually get started into the meat of the Protein Power Plan.